Hi, Bob.
Yes, good to be back, Ben, for number 30.
Number 30, yeah. It feels like a big, big, fat number, 30.
Welcome to Maui. You're here. All the people who tap my phone are listening.
Yeah, and it's dark here. Dark, dark, dark.
And it's that's Watson, W-A-T-S-O-N. Okay, you got that right.
Yeah, right.
Ben Watson. Of course, I'm in London.
Mm-hmm.
And we hope our Brussels mashup guy is listening eventually to this so we can work on it, massage it.
And I feel my voice is echoing in Maui. And it is.
It's resonant. It's raising the waves.
Well, that's nice.
All right. So I want to begin with an email you sent me last week. And you sent one of your sketches. Are you sending me different sketches or is it the same sketch over the last few weeks?
They're different ones.
Okay, yeah. So it's a squiggly, it's an image of what I imagine my tiny note chart is, which you can see at fivebody.com. But you wrote a description of what you're attempting, and you say, this picture is an accurate portrayal of the way I see the world. Now note, see the world. Now what about you? It's also the way you hear the world and the way you touch it is probably what you mean.
Yes.
Not just seeing, you know what I mean? So you're going to go beyond the visual in this inventory of characteristics. You say, a definite outcome which has been produced by forces so different in tendency and manners of proceeding that it takes a brainstorm to add them together. Now that's exactly what I have in my chart. I have five memes, five competing ways of looking at things. All right? Or that are general archetypal, been around a long time. So the interplay you're describing, a definite outcome, the sketch has been produced by forces so different in tendency and manners of proceeding that it takes a brainstorm to add them together. And that brainstorm is the sketch itself. That's the result of the brainstorm. One example might be the combination of igneous, sedimentary and metamorphosed rocks in the Earth's crust. Then you have the contradictory poles of fascism and communism on the politics of petty bourgeois intellectuals. Then you include the alternate demands of eye, ear, and conceptual click on the mind of a writer choosing a word. That's good, this conceptual click on the mind. And that's like the present little sensory nuance. Or, another part, the various reasons certain objects might appear on a slab of pavement in an urban environment. So you see, you're beginning to include everything. Okay, this is a sketch of everything. We refuse one way, you say, of representing the world. You, we, me and you, my chart, we refuse one way of representing the world because the world we live in is not the result of one way of proceeding, but of many. Now, a lot of people live that way. They just don't know you should get on the radio and make a point of it. They don't know that artists, or maybe real artists, are trying to do that. Because most people in their normal interactions at work and that, they don't like someone who's fanatic about something. You know what I mean?
Most people
goes on too much about something.
Most people are unideological, aren't they? Very few people actually live by moralities or systems or what have you. They're kind of pragmatic about it, aren't they? Use a bit of this here and a bit of that there if it works. And they're kind of sceptical about plugging into a single idea because they feel it swallows you up and makes you a kind of rather scarily boring person.
That's right. And so we refuse, it's not just you and me, it's most people refuse one way of representing the world because the world we live in, and that's in their private life. In the public life, they get a bit, you know, it's like the old joke, people are great one-on-one, but to get them in crowds, they become stupid. So we refuse one way of representing the world because the world we live in is not the result of one way of proceeding, but of many.
Can I interrupt myself being read by you? Or do you want me to wait for you to finish it? Because
Let me finish this sentence, part.
All right.
Proceeding, but of many. Contradictory, clashing, occasionally productive meshing by participants who usually cannot understand other ways of doing things. So the world we live in is not the result of one way of proceeding, but of many. Contradictory, clashing, meshing by participants who usually cannot understand other ways of doing things. Now that is natural. Even though people reject the fanatic view, they live fanatically habitually. You know what I mean? And it is hard for them to see another way of doing things. Go ahead. What were you going to say?
Well, there are various layers to this that you're making me think of. I quite agree with you that people who don't spend their time thinking don't reduce the world to one system. But I suppose we're talking about meta-thinking. I'm talking about dealing with the problems that happen after you start thinking, so that it's like we're arguing for a set of things which you need to do once you started thinking to prevent yourself getting locked into a mode. And therefore, if you don't think at all, you're fine. But once you start thinking, you have to go all the way through to come out where you were at the beginning. Except it's not where you were at the beginning.
Yeah,
it's different.
You actually realize you didn't go anywhere, or that the process of checking where you thought you might like to go is not advisable. It's almost like constantly being an eraser head, canceling where you're going. And so you end up back. I guess it's like a good workout. You feel refreshed from the workout, and you've ended up back in the same place, same body, still not losing weight. Something like that? I'm shifting to you. We're not about thinking. We're about pointing out the pitfalls of thinking once you like doing it.
Yes. That's pretty much where... what I'm interested in. I'm not interested in starting people thinking. I think it's fair enough if they don't think. I'm not necessarily in favour of everybody thinking. But if you are going to think, then I want to point out various things that you should use to make yourself think it all the way through and to avoid the pitfalls.
And you do that by looking at things that you wouldn't think you would agree with. See, you got to push your thinking. You got to put on what you don't agree with, or what you don't think is relevant. You have to look in the crannies that you're not naturally inclined towards.
Yeah, that's the dirt beneath the rollers.
And most people won't do that. See, there's the difference.
Mm.
They are ideologically against fanatics, but they live fanatically. And they have alibis. I haven't got time. I got to get to work. I got to do this. I got to do that. I haven't got time to do all that. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Well, that haven't got time is used all the time to stop everything, everything interesting about your life. And finally, they're dead and they never had time to do anything.
And the meta process is, we were saying that the majority of humans are cool about things, but they actually undermine themselves in practice.
Yeah, I don't think we're saying that any of this takes any time at all. In fact, it's timeless. What we're talking about doesn't take time. We're not asking for time. We're not asking people to devote time to this. In fact, if they devote time to it, they get it all wrong.
That's a good point.
It's got to happen in an instant, which is also eternal, has a relationship between the instant and the eternal. But it's not, we're not arguing for some enrollment in some course that takes a long time.
No, we're just encouraging to go over here to a James McDougall concert or something that they wouldn't be inclined to and never expect themselves to experience. We're saying, come over here a little more. Look at this book fitting its wake. It's a ridiculous book, but take a look at it.
Yeah, actually take the time to have a look at it instead of just shrinking and saying, well, I haven't got time to do that because there are experts who have got the time to do it who do it, and I'm not that kind of person. And it's exactly that I want to break. I'm more interested in breaking that than I am in Finnegan's Wake.
That's right. I'm interested, and that only takes 5 or 10 minutes. We're just asking for 5 or 10 minutes.
Yes, that's all we're asking for. It's not a lot. Yeah.
And then next week, show up, and we'll do another thing completely different for 5 or 10 minutes.
I feel like we've almost reached our conclusion here. It's a bit dangerous.
We've figured out what we've tried to do.
Yeah.
So consider these shows as 5-10-minute segments, and then if you didn't hear one, listen to the next 5 or 10-minute segment of this show.
Yeah, it's trying to interrupt this streamlined necessity of trivial rubbish that everybody's so busy pursuing. But any bit of that trivial rubbish, if looked at in the light of everything, is incredibly interesting. But there's some kind of attention required to the detail which is not being done, and frustrates me that it's not being done.
Yes, so I will interrupt and we'll go back to this email you sent me. So you said, if you examine it, the sketch, you will see that my picture is sometimes drawn in black on white and sometimes in white on black, and these contrasting zones rub up against each other in ways that suggest new directions for the drawing's flow. There you are saying, look at this for a couple minutes, notice those patterns, then forget it, then come back, and the drawing should have new impact tomorrow or a different way. So you, what we just said is said here a little complexly.
Yeah, well, one of the things that struck me, I mean, just to explain that, I was very surprised. I mean, when you start reading, drawing in MS Paint, it is as easy to draw in white on black as it is to draw in black on white. Now, when you're drawing on a piece of paper, it's quite hard to draw in white on black. It's not usually done. People don't usually have sheets of black paper and good white pens. You know, they're quite unusual. Now, one thing I noticed is it's always possible to tell, simply because of the shape of the stroke, whether or not it's been drawn in black or white, or whether it's the residue, that the eye can tell. You immediately have a sympathy with the line and knowing that that was a gesture, that it went down. And I don't think this requires any expertise. It's just something you can notice if you look carefully at marks on a piece of paper. It's just something you can see. And I was quite surprised by that you can read off the trace. You can see what somebody did. You can see through it. And what interested me is if you mix up where the white marks are on black or the black marks are on white, you start looking at the edges, you start getting a slight ambiguity. You can always really see, but as you're drawing, you could start thinking of what you're leaving behind as being really the drawing in negative. It's a technique which William Blake used and theorized and got excited by. And you do enter a different realm of drawing, which isn't positivist, which isn't just saying I look and I mark and I'm a person. You're starting to think about this other side, which is what you haven't marked, as being a thing. So it's almost like non-being entering your being. You're getting the opposite of what you're doing, and becoming aware of that is suddenly opens up this huge area of possible inventions under your fingers. I mean, I'm just proposing this as a technique everybody can do, and you suddenly find that it a kind of something tips out, you know, all this stuff suddenly you can do because you've realized this truth about making a mark.
Okay, so you have this sketch, and it's an image of how you like to do your poetry or Ken Fox's poetry. This is the seamless web. But you can simplify it by saying a metaphor, which we all use every day, metaphors, is looking at one thing through another. Mm. That's what you mean. You look at white on black, and then you look at black on white. You're looking back at the white on black through black on white. That is what everybody does constantly. That's human consciousness. It's a doubleness. You're always looking at something through another. And then that's what you need to realize is the pattern happening all the time.
When you say looking at it through another, do you mean another person? I mean, there's a dialogue such as we're having. The reason that it's a dialogue is that I say something, and then in order for me to hear what you say, I have to think, well, what would that sound like to Bob? So what I've said has become objective. I've written it in black, but suddenly I realize that you are making it the other way around, or that is that what you meant?
Yeah. You don't know what you mean until you hear my response.
That's true.
You find out what Ben thinks through another, through me or anybody you're talking to. If I spell back if I just respond to what you said, that's how you know yourself.
Mm. But this is the complete opposite of the people who call themselves the hardcore Zappa fans, who always insist that if you want to find out what Frank Zappa or any artist really meant, you go and ask them, and then they tell you.
That's very naive, and that
doesn't have any dialogue in it, does it? You just keep going to the same source. You just keep going to you've got a little hole in the wall printing out ticker tape, and you keep going to the hole and waiting, and more ticker tape comes out, and you keep staring into this hole because that's the source of everything, and you don't seem to understand that the way to understand the ticker tape is to take it out and to read it, and you start writing on it yourself and poking it back into the hole. Because that would be communication with somebody.
Yeah, McLuhan summed it up when he said the user is the content. So you listen to Frank. That's you. That's your version of Frank. Then you go to Frank to see what he says, and you don't realize, no, you're going to find out from Frank what you think of Frank, and you think it's relying on his, but Frank usually doesn't tell you.
Yeah, well,
Frank is indifferent. He knows that, no, it's got nothing to do with Frank, it's you.
But our idea of...
The person doesn't know, they have to approach Frank differently. So you come to Frank, not asking what he meant. You present what you think, and even make it up, and tease him, then you'll get a response.
Well, that was our idea of getting through to Frank. When we used to plot and plan this, listening to Frank's records, it was always that we wanted to present him with what we were doing. We wanted him to see.
You and Danny, and that would be the best way to do it.
Yeah.
Because you find that Frank, he doesn't, I don't know, there's in my mind, there's all kinds of dead air situations where people talk to him and are waiting for him to explain to them, and they don't know that the Frank they want to respond is not Frank, it's themselves. It can only be yourself that's responding to Frank. You created Frank Zappa.
Yeah.
There is no Frank Zappa from Frank's point of view. So if you go and interact with Frank and totally ignore him, ignore don't display an interest in what he thinks, he then will tell you what he thinks.
Yeah.
Because he'll want to know what he thinks by your difference, through your difference.
Mm.
So definitely you've got to be a difficult fan. That's the only way to be an interesting fan. Not a violent fan, but just interacting speech-wise. You hallucinate. I mean, many times I would tell Frank what I thought of something that he did, and he'd say, that's the most absurd thing I've ever heard. Okay? He would deny that I was on the right track, but I'd get a lot of words from him about it. So I'd find out what he thought. I found out what he thought as he denied what I said.
Now, yeah,
knew I had the right to think that, but when you engage with someone, they will deny that. That's the joke of conversation.
Yes, and you've described to me, I mean, you're describing talking to Frank Zappa, but you've explained to me what I do when talking in general, or how I deal with reality, which is often to propose the most preposterous set of connections that I can think of in order to irritate reality so that it speaks back at me.
That's right. And then you find out what you meant.
Yeah.
You, isn't that a paradox? You need to find out what is not you to tell you what you did.
Uh-huh.
So figure that out. I mean, is there one or two? Are you talking beyond yourself or not? See, that's the subtle dialectic of existence. You actually rely on not you to find out what you don't think. Or what you do think. It shifts. It's black on white, white on black. That figured ground changing is constantly happening.
Yeah.
And so the average person, the average consumer is fanatic. They think it's only one way.
This goes back, doesn't it, to the Wittgenstein thing about the rabbit or the duck, the figured ground, or the optical illusion where you have a picture of two lovers about to kiss and you can see it as a vase or you can see it as two lovers kissing.
Yeah.
And often this is taken by quite miserable philosophers into a kind of tragedy that either you see it as one or you see it as another.
Well, and Wittgenstein said, we cannot speak of some things. Remember that famous line?
Yeah, darum muss man schweigen. Yeah, over that which you can't speak, you must be silent. Which is tautology. And tautologies always have a great sense of grandeur and miserableness about them.
Yeah, but here's the thing. That statement was probably striking at its time in its context for the audience or people at that time. So it's not an eternal value, but it might have been striking he reminded people, well, there's an area of silence. That's half the story.
But what I like about what you're saying about the figure ground changing is instead of it being a kind of awful paradox in which nothing's settled and we can't decide which to go with, it's actually the on-off of discussion, that interpreting what somebody else has said by looking at the negative shape of what they've said isn't this sort of but we can never really posit what's true because we're constantly flip-flopping between one version and another. It's actually the basis of dialogue and of living thinking, that without that we wouldn't be able to talk. And this is Voloshinov's linguistics, that without ambiguity in a word, we wouldn't be able to talk to each other. It's the very fact that the signs we use are being struggled over, that when I say a word, it's got a different spin from yours, that enables us to have a conversation. If we always meant exactly the same by the two words that we're using, we wouldn't really have any discussion.
Exactly, and I'm tempted to say that's what was wrong about the statement, one size fits all. But I don't want to get distracted. I'm just.
But we'd be like hardcore Zappa fans who, when they meet, all they can do is compare each other's lists of the materials. So they can't really talk. All they can say is, I'm same, you same. They're both the same. But if two things are the same, they're not having a discussion. They're just, I don't know what they're doing. They might as well be laid out next to each other dead.
They're actually being intolerant. In one of his later interviews, Zappa was asked, what's the solution with, you know, the post-Reagan era and all that? And he said, well, we should be a little more tolerant. Well, what? He's all for tolerance. But the thing is, tolerance means you interact with those you don't agree with. Mm. You must learn to engage with them. That's the shaking up of your own tunnel vision.
Mm.
And if you can't find anybody to agree with, then create alternative views just to have someone respond to them.
I mean, I've never had much fun just arguing with people who I disagree with, you know, where it's a debate and you're just trying to score points. I've never enjoyed that. But I think I understand you. You see, I need a third term. I need a common object. That's why I don't think there's any dialectics without materialism. Because what we need is a external object which is different from both of us for us to struggle over. We need a sign. Our spins on it are different, but it's the same sign that we're arguing about, which is why I find, for example, Frank Zappa's music or his albums useful, because they are something external to you and me that we can both refer to and then develop our preposterous contradictory theories about and then get talking, and then we can actually get somewhere because we know what we're both responding to. And having that object there seems to me useful, and that's what art should be supplying us with, is objects for discussion which are external to ourselves and can be investigated and we can argue about.
Well, that's what, you know, Finnegan's Wake ends with, the keys to given. That's what reality is. It's the third position given to us.
Yeah.
And then reality is created by language, and then all the later media inventions create realities. That's the object. So then we can argue over what is the art object that is to be discussed. And today there's so many objects in the mass mind, in the middle there, that everybody can see, that we actually can't find a common object anymore. That's part of the problem today.
Which is why we had a call in some earlier programs for a monoculture, didn't we? We said, sweep it all away, only Dumitrescu matters. Let's cut all this variety, this that people thought was so liberating, that everybody is allowed to have their own obsession and their own culture and everything, is actually boxing everybody in these separate boxes. Let's listen to something that just throws the whole of music into chaos and dismisses it as a racket. Let's take Dumitrescu and start again. And paradoxically, choosing just that one thing can actually allow a multiplicity of opinions to arise. And it's finding that thing and positing it, which seems to me the task of the critic, which you give up once you accept that, well, I'm merely doing a guide for these people over here.
That's right. That's the role of Finnegan's Wake. It's the ultimate new object for common reaction to. That's the role of Finnegan's Wake, is to be that object, because it includes the fragmenting process as a mirror within it, back to you. There's nothing more perfect. It's McLuhan, as McLuhan said, Joyce solved the Esperanto problem. He found a way to unite the world.
Right, so it's designed as a common object for us all to be able to face, but it's so designed that no expert can get on top of it and become the interpreter that you must trust and not look at the object itself, that they're always going to slip off it because there'll be some area that they don't understand or areas of absolute murk which will resist them, and so they can't take it over and interpret it in a way that could turn it into a religion. It's basically an anti-religious book against any kind of systematic understanding of it from that you could take on trust or Yeah?
Yeah, no, like my chart and like your sketch, the terms of my chart refer back to Finnegan's Wake. So that Finnegan's Wake always is showing the pitfalls of making something extra out of Finnegan's Wake other than its active living role of providing the critical object to work with. You know what I mean? It also includes warnings about what you're doing as you're doing it. And not just about speaking or writing, but warnings about too much radio, too much television, or not enough computer. He's got all that warning about those environments in there. And then that would come back to when you do your Ken Fox or your talking. You're showing the seamless web of language, but I think it focuses too much on the orality part of language and misses the other things. But maybe you think your words, because you jump all over the place, it's surrealistic, you think the words are referring to other objects. But Finnegan's Wake points out the environmental seamless web, not just of the seamless web of language. And most people think Finnegan's Wake is just reminding us of the seamless web of language in etymology, but it's more than that. That's what is extra, and that's what the McClune Bob Squad is on about. That part, as opposed to surrealistic Ken Fox's verbal seamlessness.
Well, I don't think Ken Fox. We're talking about a poet who is also a DJ on community radio in Regina in Canada.
And the James McDougall of Canadian radio.
And recently, well, he's a dropout from the postmodern poetry scene who read my book on Frank Zappa and decided I was correct and decided to become oppositional to all his previous allies. And he's written his latest thing, is called Scandella of Wascana, and I've been reading it on my late lunch show, which appears on Resonance on Wednesdays at 2. And I'm not sure I agree, Bob. I mean, this is an impression you've got of the work when I fold it in with music tracks and me talking on my shows. So maybe I've done him a disservice, because when I read it, I thought this is the first objective prose I've read since The Childermas by Wyndham Lewis that has an erotics of enunciation which and I think it's very semantic. I think it's not just the sound of the words, it's about death and materials and oil and the world, and it's very excited by pumps and the physical imagining the physical traction required to make an industrial society work, and then below that to make the earth's crust appear above the rock. It's imagining all that, and it's excited by the fact of imagining it, and it and then it lists it and it incants it. So I don't think it is merely drunk on what words can do. It has this strong erotics of the physical, which also reminds me of what happens when you fall asleep and you fall into the grinding of your own bodily processes. And I think it's the atmosphere of The Torture Never Stops by Frank Zappa, which I think is a descent into that zone of sleep. When men fall asleep, they develop hard-ons, and it's an erotic area of complete wish fulfillment, where you forget the concepts, and you enter a different part of your nervous system, and you connect to your bodily processes, and that grinding, that sound which you hear in The Torture Never Stops is for me what that is.
It's this, continuing your email to me, this is describing Ken's writing. You say, likewise, shapes are generated by observation, in brackets, the original sketch of coq au vin. What's coq au vin?
Ah, this is coq au vin. It's French, and it means chicken cooked in red wine. And okay. I found this a very stimulating visual object to start drawing, because it's full of tendons and strands of the animal's innards scattered in ways which, if you trace out with a pen, you get something which is very uncomputerish. It's not the kind of facile things generated by fractals and so on. It has a, and I feel that because there's a whole ruggedness of actuality which computers can't capture, and I'm interested in presenting the internet world with what I think's been so far missed out, and therefore drawing coq au vin is for me my protest against the smoothing and the abstracting of reality into numeric generated imagery.
So that is more anamorphosis than fractal.
Yeah.
Right. So you say, likewise, shapes, and this is Ken's, I'm applying this to Ken, but you're describing your own sketch. Likewise, shapes are generated by observation, the original sketch of coq au vin, gestural reflex or scribble, historic patternings, in brackets, Viking, animal art, Greek classical ornament, Celtic spirals, etc., cartoon motifs, jokes, visual puns. That is what you're getting in Ken's prose, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to show that that is the environment around us. Not in just in language, but in the web, in the wonderful world we experience every day.
Yeah, but this is the revolution that we're proposing, is that what we're responding to, which other people say is our taste in art, is not a taste in art. It's a taste for reality, which some art is telling us about.
That's right. It's your next sentence. You have the drawing as a trace. So Bob and Ben is a trace of incompatible modes of proceeding and mocks the so-called beauty, in fact sterility, of media which stick to one mode. Mm. They all stick to one mode. The point is to play in the not allowed area between two modes. Now that can sound dramatic, but not allowed is, you come up to someone on the bus stop and you show him Finnegan's Wake, and you don't want him to spend much time with it, but you spend 30 seconds describing how the book is a mating of radio and print. Something like that is not allowed, right?
Uh-huh.
And the point is to play in the not allowed area between two modes. Now, that's the resonant interval that McLuhan made so much about, and that's really what Joyce is working with. Then you say, this corresponds to both the Wake, it's as set and finished as the Book of Kells, but the result of so many avenues of interest and ways of using language that it can't be reduced to one vision. See, that's why in your show, and this is a cliche vision, it goes back to the Dadaists or maybe before, the collage, as McLuhan said, collage is the only viable art form in the 20th century. You begin with collage because we live collage, but then how do you translate it into daily life and politics? How do you live the collage?
Oh.
How do you get the politician to
recognize? Well, the thing is that I'm going out for my taste simply as a beginning of communicating an argument, but I've got sick of collage. I've got sick of postmodern music, which is snatches of little music stuffed next to each other of incompatible genres. I've got sick of bright images I see which take one photograph and lay it next to something from another. And that's why I'm drawing everything again, because I want the splatter of gesture and my body back in it. Because the problem I find with collage is that it can not admit that something is being slapped down on paper by a hand. And I'm interested in doing stuff that's learnt from collage and has the absolute ease and plastic, here comes everything of collage, everything can go in, but I want it redrawn. And I think I've learnt this from Karl Schenkel, who redraws machinery, for example. I mean, Dadaists love to take a photograph of some machinery and then stick it in their pictures, because at the time no one did that, and it was so shocking. And what is this machinery suddenly in a oil painting? You know, this is so bizarre. But Karl Schenkel understands that, but then he draws it all in his style, his wobbly pen line, and I find a charm in that and something charged and exciting. And it's almost like let's gobble all the shocks of surrealism and collage and absorb it so that it then becomes personal expression again, that we can be individuals drawing and expressing, like in the sort of old bourgeois sense, but in from a new perspective of having absorbed so much imagery and so many ways of proceeding. So it's kind of expressive and single-minded and therefore beautiful because everything is coming from the same hand. And I personally think my drawings are very beautiful because they're all through my hand. But after a collage consciousness. I mean, I'm not doing collage. I'm doing drawing.
That's right. And the mono, when we say we're asking for a new monoculture, the monoculture stands on the 20th century of collage, and the best archetypal model of that is Finnegan's Wake.
And so Finnegan's Wake has this, because in Finnegan's Wake, the words are smashed into each other and everything, but everything is digested into Joyce's personal rhythm. And I was thinking of John Coltrane when we were talking about the non-allowed spaces between two modes, that John Coltrane, his whole music is about the clash of world scales. He spent his whole time transcribing scales from different world music albums that were scattered around his house. He's writing down all these different scales, and when he's playing, he's trying to actually deal with the whole world of music and all the different scales and be able to play his way through it, but in an expressive, embodied way. It's not a mechanic. You see, so many of these ideas have been taken by the kind of academics of modern art, who then take themselves away and the risk of being an expressive person and try to do it mechanically. They're going to combine this and this, and they put it on their resume. I combine this and this. It's very good to combine world cultures. But what they actually produce is some horrible system of using samples that just sets these things one after the other and has no risk of their own expressive body in it anymore. Whereas I think John Coltrane is a far better example, a far braver example, because he gobbled it all up and then spat it out from him. And that,
yeah, and
Finnegan's Wake does that. Finnegan's Wake is not a mechanical thing. It's just imbued with Joyce's own rhythms. He's prepared to be a lyric poet in the end.
But he's not expressing himself in isolation or in hypersubjectivity. That's why it doesn't end. It allows you to interrupt it.
Yeah, he's not expressing himself. He's becoming a channel for expressing everything. It's not a personal or private expression, but he's not. He's allowing all the words to be digested. He's trusting to his instincts. He's not distrusting the instincts, because an awful lot of. I mean, Dada starts with a reaction against expressionism, but Dada is really a super form of expressionism, saying it's even more expressive of where we are in the modern world to tear up a popular magazine and stick it on a piece of paper than it is to do a woodcut of a suffering person. They were really expressionists, and this gets forgotten because they said down with expressionism. People think Dada's the opposite of expressionism and merely conceptual. It's not. It's an extremely... it punches you on the nose when you see it. It's incredibly expressive art.
Okay, so that means it's expressive in the sense it wants an expressiveness returned to it by the respondent, by the audience.
Yeah.
It's asking you to express yourself in response.
Yes. It wants a reaction. But it's using... You see, I think you can use the expressiveness of expressionism as an offence. And I think that's required to make art electric and communicative and worth doing. And I just see so much fear of self-expression, immediately assuming that it's got to be bourgeois and personal, which then leads people to a dry, formalist academicism as being, you know, the correct way of proceeding. And this has produced the kind of, just the roomfuls of dead modern art.
Maybe that's why Alice Coltrane, you know, didn't get the point of John Coltrane, and she tried to keep it unresponsive or to make it platitudinous or something.
Yeah, you know, she pioneered the way into New Age music, didn't she? Because she removed all the edges and produced a kind of sublime which hasn't got the writhing, expressive individual anywhere in it anymore. And it's not...
The line from the Ancient Mariner that McLuhan used to use, we were the first to break into that silent sea. She mistakes the silent sea as silent.
And she doesn't understand that we have broken into it and we are we still.
Yeah. in other words, there was a lot of people there before you got there, and you've broken into that raucous tavern when you thought you were going up to the top of the mountain and to be removed. So this interaction is the issue. So when you can't help but present collage on Out to Lunch, and you do it, you think, with a way of altering too much verbality or too much orality or something, or taste, or you target, you produce collage every out to lunch, even though you're bored with visual collage.
Well, I'm against musical collage. It's John Zorn has put me off it. Because
are you doing collage in your show?
I'm interested in the space between modes. I'm interested in shock, and I'm interested in upsetting people's idea of what they themselves like, or suggesting that where they thought they were isn't so great or is better than they thought it was. I'm interested in slipping materials that they might think beneath them or above them in a context which allow them to hear them for what they are, which is note patterns, which might be pleasing or displeasing to them. So I'm trying to remove the associations of culture so that you can respond to it more directly.
Yeah, you are actually doing what the opposite of what you're stating here. The problem with postmodernism, it states collage or the conflicting visions in the not allowed area as an ideal. You drop that, and then you try to start over again. And that's why we emphasize Finnegan's Wake. We actually can say we now know how to organize society. We now have the way to do it.
And this is the meaning of recorso, which is Vico's system of the development of humans. He sees a crisis happening when all the good things have been achieved, that you've brought the gods down to earth and you brought the heroes down to earth and everything has become democratic and we're all talking to each other and there is no mystery anymore and we become rational. He sees a problem with that, and it's the task, he saw it as requiring what he called a recorso, which is actually setting things off, including all the advances, but shaking everything up to come back to a new level, and the whole system goes round again.
Yeah, and I'm speaking from the point of the golden age that comes after the recorso, the beginning of the new. Where I'm announcing Finnegan's Wake as the beginning point. We've been through the recorso. Now, it's not a naive transition past recorso. Recorso's included. That would be the tetrad. The enhancement, obsolescence, retrieval, and flipping into opposite. That process, recorso, becomes subsumed. So we actually, this show is claiming we're past the recorso.
Yeah, we don't need to. I mean, maybe late lunch is doing the recorso, and this is the...
Yes, I would say you're still out to lunch, you're still in the recorso message mode. And this show is past the recorso. That's why we're saying we're the only ones who get it. We've arrived. We've left the silent sea. We're back on land.
We're back on land, and you'll notice there's no music and there's just us.
Okay, so now take this and use your neighborly example that you were mentioning you wanted to bring in, talking about music.
Because recorded music breaks through to a new democratic level, and this is what's not understood about recorded music. Recorded music is mainly understood as a new means of selling music. We used to sell sheets of music, now we sell plastic discs of music, a completely banal repetition of the old capitalist way of dealing with music, and that's how it's usually thought about. It ignores one thing, which is that when you bought a sheet of music to play in the past, you had to know how to play it. Now all you have to do is know how to switch on your record player. But the performance required when you put on a record is not simply that you lie on the floor and listen to the music, which is what quite a lot of people do with their records, or all kinds of things people do with their records, but the performance is actually you talking about it. That you talking about the music and articulating what you think about it is the new level of democratic understanding of your body and history.
Because that's the translation. That's metaphor.
Music.
The ear experience into the mouth experience.
Yeah, in translating it, you're taking music, which is a sedimented content of the development of peoples. That's what music is. It's a formal residue of actual practices, that every time you hear a courtly lyric, every time you hear a Baroque concerto, these are ways of life embedded in these pieces of music. And to talk about it is actually to express, or you hear plain song, or you hear church music, what you think of all those centuries of people behaving in that way, or rock and roll, or whatever the music you listen to is. You are making a comment on how you feel about all those people having done this stuff in the past, and what your opinion is of it.
And right, now go into your neighbour.
Okay, yeah. Well, I have a neighbour who used to run Ray's Jazz, a record shop in London. He's recently, like me, given up his work to take care of a baby. And he came around, and I played him. I know he has a taste for slightly dubious classical music, so I put on Rosenkavalier by Richard Strauss. Now, this is erotic Viennese opera, where they loved having a lead male played by a woman, because then he could show her legs, and they're singing a love duet, and he's presenting a rose, and it's like all the very strained kind of high-pitched bits of Mozart, like sort of purified into this absolutely effective erotic sound. And I was playing this to him because I thought he'd enjoy it. And Richard Strauss uses this percussion over the strings. There's a kind of strained strings playing, and then this ching 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 percussion. And I said to him, that's where I think where Olivier Messiaen got his ching 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 from, even though Olivier Messiaen sold it as his total serialism. And you can hear it all the way through to Pierre Boulez. And then Phil said to me, I really like it when people listen to a piece of music and say what they think of it like that. I can't stand people who've been to music college who have been told by somebody else what the history of music is and then tell you that. What I like is people speculating and hearing bits of music and talking. And I said to Phil, yeah, so do I. In fact, that's been the great pleasure of my life, is talking with other people about records and suggesting that this might be so. And then you might go and do some research. You might go and read a biography of Messiaen and find out, did he ever listen to Richard Strauss? But believing in the evidence of your ears, you yourself, because you can listen to a record, and being able to take that seriously and talk with other people about it, is for me what music gives us. That's what popular music, listening to music on records, is about. And it enters a new era, a new realm of your relationship to history, which is embodied in musical sound. And this is under attack all the time by people who claim to be experts, who are going to take little areas of punk or jazz and then start being the experts on it, who know all the stuff and will tell you what the real connections are and what the musicians actually said. And they're denying our right to think about music. And I've got a great quote from Adorno which summarizes these ideas for me. As soon as one starts to talk about music, one enters the realm of thought, and no power on earth has the right to silence this. He wrote that in 1957.
Say that again.
As soon as one starts to talk about music, one enters the realm of thought, and no power on earth has the right to silence this.
Right, so isn't it interesting that capitalism continued over the last 50 years through charging for talk? It's people pay to hear people talk about stuff they're consuming.
Mm-hmm.
That's like the after image of the means of production. It talked. That was the political point of Finnegan's Wake. The word talk becoming the new capitalist drug.
Yeah.
Because that's what you're complaining about. People are paid to be the experts. And that's what everything revolves around.
Yeah,
what do the experts say?
And if you carry on talking about music and entering the realm of thought, you get closed down, which is my experience in the world of music criticism, and Richard Meltzer's experience is that if you carry on an attitude about recorded sound which is your own responses are primary, and that's the first thing, is registering your body's responses to the music and then going out towards the knowledge in order to shape it, like you are a magnet and the knowledge is iron filings which are going to be shaped by the interest, what you're going to pursue is shaped by your response. If you insist on that, you get closed down, because your responses will not be okay according to the known quantities, which are quantities of what's sold. Because nobody actually fits the demographic. if you find any individual, they are not the same as what their demographic ought to be. They're irregular, they don't fit. And that has to be closed down if any critic is too loud about insisting on a personal reaction as being primary. They're going to be shuffled out because they're not playing the game of insisting that everything is known and the values are set and the very good stuff is there and, you know, we know what we're doing. And in fact, music is so various and multiplicious and so detailed and so ironic. There are continually points in it in which the things which are considered completely abysmal can be redeveloped into something absolutely fantastic. I mean, this is Frank Zappa's method, continually finding things that you thought were the pits. I mean, you know, music you never want to touch, and showing that you can, they can be used, and that you suddenly get a new insight into history of peoples and what that music was used for and what it meant, which is like waking up to history, that history is made by people. And that no people are really hateful.
Beg your pardon?
And no sets of people are really hateful. You know, you think you can't stand...
Look, this was the political message of Finnegan's Wake that McLuhan adapted. He wrote a letter to Ezra Pound on June 22nd, 51, and he says something about the problem in your era, back, you know, the time of the Vortices, was so-and-so. I can't remember what he said. But today, words have become a drug. And he says, I'm working on that problem. And that's why Finnegan's Wake was his political guide, because the Wake, on one level, is showing that the capitalist empire continues through talk, through what we call software. Mm. And it's the software imperialism, which was a new subtle thing. Most of the 20th century, people entertained listening to all kinds of stuff and experts talk, and they learned a lot because they never went to school or they didn't know, never heard. There was always, like McLuhan said, the classroom without walls. But this subtle subliminal seduction was, that's what was going to undermine any revolution, because the means of production moved to talk, and talk now had been the new commodification. That is the political point of Lewis and Joyce, and McLuhan saw that. That's what I'm always referring to.
So this talk
is objecting to.
Is that what I would call the assumption that, I mean, within media, that everything is immediately understood, that the current language, which is quite a few set of words, is transparent, everybody knows what everybody's saying, and that Finnegan's Wake reminds you of how alien what comes out of mouths actually is.
Yes, but it also makes a political point. That little one-tenth of Joyce that was a Marxist, he wouldn't limit himself to anything because he could do it all. I mean, that great line he said, well, McLuhan described Joyce as being able to live in any cultural mode that existed, go from one to another. Mm. Now,
Marx's favorite quotes was, it's an old classical tag, which is, nothing human is foreign to me.
That's what Joyce said, right?
Yeah. Well, it's...
Now, that's the tolerance I'm talking about. That's what your little manifesto is.
Yeah.
Now, the interesting thing is that technology had evolved to the point, and this is where McLuhan said Marx missed, that variability to live in all cultural modes, the postmodern ethos, is the final gasp of capitalism. That's what's interesting.
But this tolerance for different modes requires an extreme revolutionary intolerance for the pseudo understanding which keys all this into particular places and doesn't take it seriously and allows us to consume a little bit of this and a little bit of that because we know where it is, when in fact we don't know where it is because we're not in it.
That's right. So the specialist experts, they are paid to talk on the Android meme in the TV landscape and radio landscape and all that, and in Wall Street, and yet they will not go to a James McDougal concert. They will not listen to Ken Fox. Or if they do, they describe it, they'll respond to it as an expert and put it on their commodified wallpaper, their lifestyle wallpaper that Zappa used to make fun of. That's the thing. We're in this incredible... So we're saying no more talk. We have arrived at all the solutions. And then you show them Finnegan's Wake. That's your solution? They'll say, well, I don't understand this. How could this be the solution? Well, let's talk about it.
Yeah, and it's talk generated by people who aren't us by presenting them with this stuff that we think matters.
That's right. That's why Joyce said he's the greatest engineer that ever lived. Imagine that. Not many people know that quote. He said, I'm the greatest, I mean, he might have said greatest human engineer, but I'm the greatest engineer that ever lived. Why would a guy say that? Well, he understood the imperialism of talk would take over. He held a mirror up with it, up against it, and then he created an Esperanto to deal with it. On a practical level, we could rebuild your churches by discussing not the Bible,
okay,
his wake. That's the way you revitalize Christianity or Buddhism or anarchism or any religion or mode that you are fanatically devoted to. Even
fantastic,
Marxism.
Bob. So we hope that by next week when people listen to us again, they'll all have had a look at least at Finnegan's Wake. But I've got to stop you there because our time is up. Thanks very much, Bob.
Thank you, Ben.